tell me that I was not economically viable. And then, yeah, I think it was 7 years. 7 years. Excuse me, sir. Excuse me. How'd your loan ever go? Did they give you a loan? He must be economically viable. There's a man with a smile on his face. He looks like a happy customer. That's what an economically viable person looks like.
Oh, hello, Winter Park, Central Florida. You have just, I know, you know, I know you haven't said anything, but you have just tuned into Punkonomics here on WPRK, Winter Park, Florida, hosted by Dr. Benny Ballack and myself, Jesse Valesa. And for those of you who are wondering why I'm laughing so much, is we received hate mail. Yeah. And yes, thank you for all of you out there for your comments and stuff. Okay. But anyway, what can I say? Punkonomics will now be aired every Monday from 4 to 5. And temporarily, we're also going to be on Friday mornings for the summer until somebody bumps us off. Anyway, with no further ado, here's our host, Dr. Ballack.
Hello. So we have a special treat. Before I share with you some of the fun morning hate mail, or was it last evening? I don't know. I'm grading all the time. But anyway, we have a special treat after we get rid of shamelessly promoting that hate mail and enjoying it thoroughly. Kind of, you know, it's kind of nasty too. But we're also going to do something special today. The treat is that we're going to have one of the, I hope I won't embarrass him, because, well, he's probably not hearing yet, so this is the time before I call him to say that he is one of the best, you know, students any of us have seen here ever, you know. He's off in Colorado getting a PhD. And if anybody's going to try and make the world a better place, or at least fix economics so we're a little bit less pathetic as a field, as a discipline, that would be him, right?
Awesome.
So I will now simply attempt to call him on my phone. Thank you for the unlimited long distance. Well, I won't say whom, right? That would be wrong.
Right.
And I'm just calling him on the phone, and then we're going to experiment with the sounds and see if the microphone is best or if a direct line is best or whatever works best. And we're on the line. I'll wait till he's on the line before I actually present him officially.
Well, it's kind of fine. You know, take it
always tried. What? Oh, yeah. Hey, Jose, you're there?
Thank you. You know what? Why don't you? What's your name?
And we're going to experiment for the
Stuart.
First time.
Okay. Here we go. Stuart, why don't you go ahead and say hi to the audience out there, and also, you know, just repeat what you just finished saying.
Yeah, man. Cool. What's up, Orlando? You got to keep it tuned in WPRK. This is a great show. You know, just for the haters, let them hate, because it ain't gonna stop the good people from loving.
Awesome.
That's it.
And where are you calling from, Stuart?
Dean Road in Econ, right up there by Valencia.
All right. Yeah, I kind of live in that area myself. I own water before it lakes. But anyway, I'm glad that you like Punkonomics. And again, we're going to be here every Monday from 4 to 5, and also temporarily for now until we get bumped off. Of course,
Friday at our usual or post-usual time, 9 to 10. So anyway, Stuart, thanks a lot. We definitely appreciate your comments.
Hey, definitely, man. Keep up the good work, brother.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
So, okay, back to Punkonomics here, Dr. Balak, and I guess we have our caller. All right, Dr. Balak, and
Let's see how this works, you know? I mean, there he is, look.
Go ahead. Hey, there he is. Okay, so...
Will it come from there? So, Jose, can you say hello so we see if we hear you?
Hello, yeah, I don't know. Can you hear me well?
Do we? We can go the other side? Would that be...
That'd probably be better. There we go. Go ahead.
Try again.
Hello? Can you hear
me? Yeah, we can hear you. We can hear you.
I'm putting all the volume I can get into it in case it's not.
Yeah, we...
Try again, just so we're sure we are here.
1, 2, 3.
Yeah, that works. Hello?
Or should we try the line in instead, just to be sure?
Yeah, we're probably better off doing the line in.
Maybe, right? Let's try that. Let's try that while... why don't you do that while I tell our listeners about the headband and all that?
What are we up to today?
It's up here. Look, it's right there.
Ah, there it is.
Got a mean fly.
Yeah, talking about lo-fi, huh?
This will probably... I mean, usually it gets a pretty good signal.
How's that, Jose? Yeah, no, it cuts it off. Anyway, tell our audience about...
What cuts off?
It cuts off the volume.
What?
Yeah, it's off. And anyway,
maybe.
Yeah.
No, that's Bluetooth. Oh well, I'll tell. That's weird, though. I mean, you usually. I can hear Oh God, this. I know. You know, probably I'm not the only person. Sometimes these phones are so smart. You end up pretty stupid.
Exactly. Well, exactly.
As now. We're doing some pretty fancy analog stuff, just so you guys know why we're giggling a little bit. We're putting the phone, the very smart phone, on the disc and placing the microphone kind of above it and seeing what happens then.
Yeah, shout out to Shaheem who's sending me all these text messages just so he can hear the phone go bling.
But hopefully we'll get Jose Galvez, who's like I said, alumni getting his PhD in the University of Colorado, and he'll tell us a whole bunch of stuff. And if not, I guess we could also try on calling with this old landline phone to him. Maybe you know how to make a long distance call from this place.
Yes, I do.
Well, we could do that. That's another try.
That could be another try.
If the sound doesn't really do it for us.
Okay, Shaheen, stop busting in Texas here. They're driving us crazy with these beeps.
Okay, we're probably boring people, though. And, you know, well, I just have to force Jose to come back again if we can't get anything to work. Welcome to my world. But, well, I got the very first hate mail today, and I wanted to share it with everybody. I approved it. You know, you get to approve comments and stuff.
Right.
But I definitely approved it. Now, first of all, funnily enough, it was on a... pretty innocuous little article I just reposted about how, you know, the wealthier people in America, I believe in that study it was a top 7% that they were happened to look at those numbers, have been doing pretty well, have been getting richer, if you will, have certainly more than recovered, some actually making out like bandits like never before, since the crisis of 2008. Where the bottom, again, in this study, 93% have gotten poorer to different degrees since 2008. And, you know, nothing much. I mean, considering some of the stuff we've posted and discussed around here, you know, more taboo than that. But anyway, so what did I get? I get a message from God. So one moment I got a little bit of a, you know, kind of an eerie... kind of,
oh, is that guy on Facebook? No.
It's not on Facebook. It's on the blog. It's on the
punkonomics.org.
It's a WordPress blog. So God, first of all.
Hey, God.
That's impressive, right, Mr. God? Interestingly enough, when you try and see who is this God person, because call me a skeptic, but I didn't think it was from the Almighty. There I found that they gave an internet address that, refers to the desire to engage in a certain form of...
amorous, romantic activity with me of the kind that being a heterosexual guy with two kids is not really up my my cup of tea, shall we say, though I have nothing against it, naturally. Did I manage to explain what the word without referring to the exact... well, there you are. Whatever, but it gets nicer when what he says, quite simple really, and I say he because I somehow doubt that that's a lady. You have no idea what you're talking about, filthy Jew. Yep.
She actually said that. What a lady.
Filthy. No, I'm sure it's not a lady. Not because of the filthy Jew so much as because of the, you know, homophobic, disgusting kind of comments about what he'd like to do to me. It's funny how homophobes often like to refer to acts that they apparently do not appreciate, you know, but somehow really feel, well, okay, that's another matter, right? But anyway, you know, I have been already on some hate lists, but one hate list before, would call me self-hating Jew, and now I got somebody calling me a dirty Jew, so I suppose now I'm a, you know, dirty self-hating Jew, and that's perfectly fine.
So is that an improvement, or is that...
And I wrote a little comment about it, in case anybody interested, on the internet, right? So, you know, that just spread everywhere or to punkonomics.org.
And where's that page at, Dr. Balak?
It's the punkonomics.org, which is... our own, you know, my own blog, basically. It's kind of the hub from which all the stuff comes to Facebook, Twitter, blah, blah, blah. All that stuff.
Get him on the phone, tell him I'm going to call him from an Apple device.
Okay, yeah, try that. Okay. Yeah, I'll even, you know, text him so I'm not, like, talking on the phone in the middle. Yeah. So that was, you know, it's not really fun. I mean, I suppose, you know, that means, because look, we're not shock jocks, right? I mean,
right. Yeah, we're not Howard Stern here. So, I mean, Stern, or that's right, it is Stern.
You got this number, right?
Cause I already got
it. I want him on, you know, and if not, I'll, you
know. So I'll just call it from my Apple device.
I want him on, I want his girlfriend on.
All right.
I want him all on.
So, is he not calling him?
Yeah, I told him you're calling him now, so hopefully he's not like me that doesn't answer anybody's phone because I'm a bit of a phonophobe. I'll admit I really don't like phones. I don't know what it is, really. It's funny, it's not shy. I'm talking on the radio, but I hate talking on the phone. I don't know why. I love texting, actually.
So tell me a little bit more about this hater. Why
that's it, really. I'm a little surprised. I don't know where, you know. It doesn't really matter that much. My more experienced blogger colleagues, I just actually had a little chat of that earlier today in the middle of... grading no. Says don't feed the trolls.
Don't feed the trolls.
That's what he explained to me. But
all right, he's on.
But oh well.
Good.
Hello?
There we go, that's better.
Okay, strike one for Apple, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So maybe that worked better. So there's the story. I mean, it's really not important. Hate mail. I don't think. I just want to say that, you know, we deal with things that are perhaps sometimes taboo. You know, certainly in mainstream media, it might pull strings, but we really do every effort. And Jose knows that. We've talked about it over the years. Trying to be entertaining. Jose actually very much influenced me in the sense that, you know, that make, if you can make him laugh, you know, make him listen, you know. But also really trying to be, we joke, equal opportunity haters, all that sort of thing. But we mean it, you know. We really criticize everybody where we see fit. You know, we're absolutely not Democrat or Republican aligned or anything like that. And we certainly preach, I don't know if that's the right word, but call, beg, you know, for solidarity, for to look beyond that sort of thing. And
exactly,
I think a lot of people
right
in
thing.
America, mm-hmm. while we are divided in horrific ways and just the level of racism and shrill hate is depressing, it's not the first time. There are a lot of people who are, I think, on board with this, right? So, you know, it's just one hater. Who cares, you know, quite honestly, you know. Unless he lives in this neighborhood, I wish I could get an IP trace, you know.
Well, can always do that. Anyway, go ahead and introduce Jose to our audience, and what are you guys going to talk about?
All right, Jose, take it away. You should be on.
Hey, how is it going?
Good.
Pretty good. I've been just studying a lot of political economy, media, and ethics lately, and I think that kind of from the on the line of what you guys were talking about, I saw this quote I would like to raise up, And I think even like the whole entertaining, the Great Gatsby is about to open, right?
Oh,
and it's a Scott Fitzgerald quote that says kind of like, the best of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposed ideas in the mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function. And I don't know. I think that this quote kind of goes at what you're what you're talking about, because I think that it is one of the problems I'm getting interested in studying a lot is how does one-directional thinking work, you know, and how does reification work, and I don't know. I think that a lot of hate speech and a lot of problems about speaking your mind, given one particular set of beliefs, you know, is a problem that can be studied sometimes by economics, particularly the one that deals with asymmetric information problems and things like such. So I don't know. That's a topic I was thinking to shoot out, and I thought it was interesting.
Okay, so first, I mean, you know, you do note, and, you know, Jose is talking, well, I think the sound, hopefully, not too distorted and things like that. We're doing our best, you know, and we'll get better.
Yeah.
But so I'll repeat maybe some of your point, and I'll make a jab at you a little bit. And you notice Jose is talking grad school English.
I know.
but that's cool, you know. That's cool.
It's okay, Jose. We're informal here, too, so.
But in a sense, first of all, the wonderful quote, and it is from the Gatsby, right? Which I will admit openly, I've never read, but I did see the old movie with Robert Redford.
Oh, me too.
Pick up the new movie. Pick up being a euphemism when it becomes available. So he's talking about to hold two ideas, the intelligence, right? I'm quoting, barely remembering, right? Trying, but the notion I think is there. That intelligence is the ability to hold two ideas, and I'm adding to it, maybe not always compatible necessarily, right? Maybe even opposing in some sense and contradicting in some sense in your head at the same time,
actually.
And not going crazy or being able to function.
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
Yeah.
And this hate speak or this ideological speech is maybe the opposite of that, right? One pure 100% idea in your head...
Yeah.
Uncritical in some sense, right? I mean, maybe the critical thinking is the dialogue.
There is a whole process of self-affirmation behind it, you know?
Mm.
Like you self-affirm yourself that you're right, therefore you're right. And that is kind of what I would call as one-directional thinking, you know? Like, and I think that media today plays a huge role in doing this, you know? In you choose what media to consume, right? And whatever media you choose, you're going to self-affirm yourself that what you believed prior to what you watched was the right thing, and there, the media is just going to help you rationalize it.
Yeah, so that's both, I guess, in the sense that you know, we pick our media, and I you know, this drives me nuts. Every time I post something against, you know, Obama, I have to say, yeah, wait a minute, settle down, Republicans, this is not, you know, for you. And every time you have all these self-congratulatory Democrats, right, I remind them that, wait a minute, you know, what's going on now is no better, if not worse sometimes. I keep posting stuff like that, so I definitely feel that frustration. And very few, though, that's what I'm talking about as getting better, I think, where you get...
Yeah.
People from opposing, you know how I post the Immortal Technique and Alex Jones. I love that interview, right?
Right.
So some people are talking to each other with an open mind, not just at each other. But you're also, so we have specific, like, do you listen to Fox or do you listen to MSNBC? You know, and each one of those perform what you described on their listeners, making them feel good, massaging their egos, reinforcing their bigotry on both sides. They're using probably similar techniques, I'm guessing, and that's what you're really kind of getting at. Like, what are the techniques to brainwash in this method?
Well, I don't know if there is a precise technique, but I think that there is a commodity there that's to be valued, and that commodity, I think, is certainty. People like to feel certain about what they believe. Mm-hmm. And surprisingly, it seems to me that critical thinking requires of uncertainty, requires of you not being able to tell, as Steven Pinker says, eureka all the time, opposed to, that's actually funny. You know, like, certainty requires curiosity and not knowing stuff, you know, being open to not knowing stuff. But I think that politics and religion tend to be places where people put certainty in. And I think as any other commodity, certainty is one, and you can consume a lot of it. You can consume too much of it and kind of become completely self-rationalized and forget about curiosity and other types of values that I think are helpful for learning.
Yeah, that's a super,
and for
yeah.
fixing stuff.
Yeah, I guess if we all look at inside ourselves, honestly, we've all smoked that pipe, haven't we? You know, of certainty, and it's a dangerous drug, I think, a very destructive one potentially.
Absolutely,
it's wonderful what you're saying because you know I was thinking, doubt. Aren't you describing doubt? I mean, you think we think religion is the place where now in science we must have doubt, and we accuse shoddy scientists that they don't have enough doubt, that they advocate their position and will massage the data. And we've had a whole show, and of course, on the recent scandal of the pay Rogoff, senility. Rogoff and who? Ken Rogoff and the paper underlying austerity, and everybody's all over it now, so we'll put that aside for a second.
Oh, yeah, Rogoff and Reinhardt?
Reinhardt, there you go. I forgot her name. But then again, you know what? The good religion has doubt, too. You know what I'm saying? I mean, even in doctrinaire, you know, Middle Ages, Catholicism discusses, you always do have, I'm not a big theologian, but, you know, you have to be interested in such an important phenomenon as religion. But you also have doubt. I like to think in my, you know, where does that evil come from in humanity? Where do the genocides and the hate come from? I like to say in a facetious way, you know, that the source of all evil is absolute faith, and that is not an anti-religious statement because serious religions have doubt. It's part of, you know, you have to have doubt. It's part of their dogma. Literally, they all have it in there. But absolute faith is what makes, you know, decent people do horrible things, and then some not decent people. But you
now,
do
here is the interesting question: do you think that science, particular economics, sometimes practices that particular way of thinking?
All the
time.
In
terms of the way they treat abstraction as if it was a concrete real event.
Oh, yeah. You're opening a can of worms. I mean, you talk about certainty.
Yeah.
I'm reminded by Sir Karl Popper, a great British philosopher of science.
You wrote Rogoff and Reinhardt ultimately, right?
Yeah, right. Don't worry, they're not listening. Though I've been all over, you know, I'm going to Eastern Economic Association next week, and there's a party for Amherst, you know, because a special party for him. And I'm all over it, saying, like, we got three of them, right? Bob Reinhardt,
well,
Phil Kozelle, and Zhao Changpeng, you know? So we got three. We're so ahead of the curve, the Department of Economics at Rollins College. We know where to get our PhDs, don't we? So Karl Popper, back in the 30s already, had this trade-off, which I think is a very useful way of thinking about it, and that is that there is a trade-off between empirical content, which is nice language for saying something about real world, you know, data, facts, you know, and certainty. So essentially, in order to be certain about something, you have to reduce, and you were saying reification stuff, you have to kind of reduce the complexities of the real world to a complete triviality. For example, I can be pretty certain that the sun will rise tomorrow morning. I can't be, by the way, entirely sure, because we might be hit by an errant meteorite that's nobody been tracking, and we'll all be dead. But I can be reasonably certain, okay? Of course, if I have to predict something a little bit more complicated, I cannot be. You see, so there's a kind of a trade-off, and I think in many cases, economics, and especially theoretical economics and neoclassical economics and the mainstream economics, anybody who's studied in economics, that's that big book with the net title Economics on it that you paid an inordinate amount of money to get and is mostly, I can't say the word over the air. But that stuff has precisely gone to the point where it's talking about so little of the real world, but it can be awfully certain about everything.
So it's almost kind of been... I heard this quote on some YouTube video that says something like, it's better to be approximately right than certainly wrong.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, I think it's very much in that spirit of what I'm kind of raising up in sense of, okay, now we know that there is this kind of problem in economics where you have theory and empirics, from my point of view, sometimes present to economists this challenge of the two opposed ideas that still need to function together, you know, very, very often, you know. And I think that it has to do with persuasion and information, but I also think it has to do with a great extent in reification, in this idea of, you're treating an abstraction as if it was a concrete real thing, you know? And I think that it's potentially dangerous, because when you think of the financial crisis, I think that a lot of what happened and that a lot of what doesn't get mentioned, but I think technicians and economists should be thinking about this more seriously, is the idea that this is what happened with risk, in financial markets, that we somehow packaged thought that we could, our model could abstract real risk in some way and packet it into a concrete real thing and sold it all over the place. And today is this toxic asset that not even Ben Bernanke knows who owns. You see what I'm saying?
Absolutely. So I've even taken a little note here because just...
It has become problematic for the whole system.
Yeah. I mean, and listen. Apparently, we need to. We're going to go to a song, and call you back because he needs to put some money on his app or something, so that the phone works. Because mine, despite all its abilities, failed us. So listen, we're gonna listen to a song and wait up for a call back, and we'll talk about precisely what you launched there, which I think is actually quite important indeed. So,
all right,
yeah, here we go. One of my favorites. Welcome back to Punkonomics. Here on the early PRK, Winter Park, Florida. The Voice of Rollins College and the Best in Basement Radio. Okay, and we have Jose back on the air with Dr. Benny Balick. And right back to the topic. Here we go. Say hi, Jose.
Hello, how's it going, everybody?
Oh, yeah, we're good.
Good.
I see the green LEDs. I don't have a headset on, but Jesse does, so that's good. So I took a kind of a brief little note here to remind us where we're at, because that's a big deal. I mean, we've even mentioned it before, you should know, with another alumni, with Corey Carroll, who's big into this sort of thing. And what you were talking about this the importance of these mistakes, you know. First of all, these are methodological mistakes. I mean, you know, it's my field. Most economists are just unaware of the developments over the past 70 years in philosophy of science. Yeah. So we're still pretending to be physicists in the 1930s, pretty much. Or 40s, shall we say. So it's pretty pathetic, frankly, the lack of sophistication that we have in the methods of our trade. But there's this guy that we like a lot, and I don't know if Well, anyway, it comes a little bit, and I'll make the plug, because he's called Nassim Taleb. He's generally an Austrian, so kind of right-wing libertarian type, of the good kind, like I like to say, the good kind.
And, is he the good kind? I want to make sure.
yeah. No, I mean, yeah, definitely. And he, you know, he's an ex-trader, so he has a real-world experience, and he's writing a lot of interesting stuff. Most famously is his book called The Black Swan, notion that people assumed that swans were always white until they saw a black one, you know? They're rare, but they're out there. But one of the things that seemed to hit when you were mentioning, remind me of the work of Taleb, is the issue of redundancy. That we have this notion, like you say, that we're reifying, right? So we believe that these theoretical, pure, abstract notions from our textbook and our maths are actually in the real world, like demand and supply. You know, it shocks most students to know that there is no such thing. It's just a way of the economists like to think of the world. Don't want to get into any... There's not much technical difficulties, actually, so let me just throw it out there real quick. I mean, imagine, anybody did economics, it's just pairs of quantities of goods and prices of goods. So each one of those is a dot. Mm-hmm. So if you just want to look in the real world and collect all of these prices and quantities over as much years and around the world, whatever you like, what you get is a big cloud of dots. Now, can you make those familiar X-shaped demand and supply in there? Not really. And Marshall himself that invented this stuff basically called them crutches for economists to help us think about the complexities of the world in our head. And he never expected that it'll make... he actually specifically said that they should never really be even used in economics, only for the you know, the notes of the writer or maybe in an appendix of a technical paper. So it's just one of those, right, when the old master that invented the stuff didn't know what the kind of monster he created, and the students ever since are misusing that tool in many cases. Not that it's not useful, right? Not that it's not useful. Now,
that's another thing I was going to point out, kind of along the two opposed ideas, you know, that you have this idea that is not actually concrete or real, that is an abstraction, but at the same time, on the opposite side, you have the problem of it being so useful to predict profits, costs for many businesses or for government budgeting or for kind of running the ship along, you know what I mean? It is still a useful concept to some extent.
Right, and when we realize, we get a little humble and we realize that we don't, it's not, the world is complicated and our models do a pretty bad job at predicting the complexities of the world, then there Taleb comes with a concrete proposal that we need to have a lot of redundancies. You know, we can't tweak everything up to the max, because if something goes wrong, the entire system collapses. No, we have to have extra. And that takes him to a point that's very dear to my heart, written about it even, is how we used to be... thinking of economics like biology, the body politic.
Yes.
It's only really like 20th century when...
And that stuff is getting into those topics, I think, more and more as you are passing.
Yeah, and it's really important. And it's also, I still remember from graduate school, I hope that people are a little bit more open today, but the notion of that the metaphor you choose... You know, that you're thinking of the economy as a body, as a organism, as a maybe human, maybe other, as an organism, a biological organism, or are you thinking of the economy as a you know, solar system in physics? What does it matter? Yeah. Get back to your math, you know, they told me. But it does matter precisely for these reasons, because physics are a completely determined system. At least not in the, I know, physicists, settle down, in the macro sense, not in the quantum level, right? But biology would teach us a long time ago that we have mass redundancies in our bodies. Why do we have two ears, two eyes, two boys? Because what happens if we lose one? Right, so the financial system should be a little bit like that too, that we realize we can't push it to the utter extreme into the red. We need to keep a little bit of redundancy, a little bit of extra just in case on the side to cushion catastrophes. So this may seem to be philosophical and methodological, but it's critical to our lives and our the sorry economic state in which most of us find ourselves today, no doubt.
Yeah. I think some advancements are being done, but they're definitely marginal. You know, I thought it was interesting that you posted that you got your first hate comment in economics today, because actually, I was just recently reading to a paper by Dharmapal and Makaram called Words That Kill, the Economic Perspective on Hate Speech and Hate Crimes.
Mm.
And they do precisely what you're talking about. They grab game theory and a lot of biology-based signaling models, and they apply it to study hate speech and how to detect it within working environments and diminish the events of hate speech and hate crimes, you know. So I think that it can be used for a very interesting purpose on one hand. On the other hand, it runs the risk of reification, right? And I think that you can see it present in many other places where that risk is generally a very big problem, right? The reification that occurs in financial markets, for example, and expectation pricing theory, a theory of rational expectation, you know, where you price an asset based on what you think it will be, you know, it's complete reification cycle, you know.
I thought it was dying already.
To be aware of it.
It was supposed to have been dead by the mid-90s, yet these zombies come again. There's a nice book about zombie and economics, actually. I signed it once. Precisely all these ideas that have died a long time ago, and they get resuscitated. Because that gets us to the political level, I suppose. I mean, what's this talking about are ways to finally, thank God, improve this field of economics of ours, which I'm sorry to say, most of it is really shameful. Though Jesse's sitting here and he's a psych major, and you know, you're worse than us. You know, you're the only ones.
There we go.
The only ones that are even worse than us, I think. So if you talk about the dangers of this stuff, yeah, indeed, psych is another field to explore in terms of, you know, what we're doing to.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And of course, as many people in psych will tell you, you can never prove anything as an exact, therefore you do need...
Then you prescribe.
Yeah, you prescribe, of course.
Ooh, I got to plug myself. What can I say, you know? Because it's funny you're talking about that, because one of the papers I'm presenting next week has got something to do with it. It's about description and prescription. So the notion that some theories, precisely the kind of theories you're talking about, the highly theoretical, irrelevant to the real world, they do a horrible job in description. They don't describe the world at all. The world is nothing like that. But they're really powerful in prescription, like the doctor prescribes medicine, right? It's a term in philosophy and methodology, right? About models have both approaches, not even just models, any kind of thought in science or in social science has these elements. So how good are you at describing the world is one question. How good are you at coming up with solutions?
Right.
Or at least proposed solution is the other question. So I think a lot of times when you, like you were mentioning earlier, right, when you try and be diligently careful about not reducing the world to the reification into believing that your models actually exist in the real world and aren't simple abstractions of the real world, for better or for worse, you run the risk. I mean, that's really good. When you do that, it's easy to prescribe stuff.
Right, right.
But your description of the world is bad. And often it's true that those that take the time and trouble to describe the world properly find themselves with not very strongly prescriptive positions. So it's kind of hard to... So what you're going to do about it is a difficult question to answer.
Right, and you know, and that's a good point. That's a good point you're making. In relation to psychology, because you really don't know if your psychologist or your psychiatrist can actually understand the way you're describing the world is really the reason why you get medicated. And the biggest problem, of course, as you know, Dr. Balick, is that you have one person prescribing, then you have the other person doing the psychoanalysis. So if both of them don't understand each other or at least talk to each other, that person is not really curing them, so they're just basically making somebody else rich.
Of course, before I let Jose get into this, but then exactly, the making somebody else rich. I mean, let's not forget the real thick layer, and today maybe we do have to work on economics too, but the horror of nobody's trying to solve our problems. It's a lobbyist game. It's a circus of the macabre. It's a crime.
It's not an economically viable solution, at least for them.
So that's a whole other layer, but it's connected, because maybe this highly prescriptive kind of economics that doesn't deal with the real world, that doesn't predict well but gives these certain simple answers, is really loved by power players, by lobbyists, right?
So that's a sinister side to it. Again, it's not neutral here.
Right.
It hurts people.
And that same model basically applies to a good example, what's going on with Syria right now. Mm-hmm. The administration doesn't know whether to go or just kind of look from afar and just send, you know, drones and that kind of
Ka-ching.
Stuff. And that's a really good example of not being able to identify or at least express, you know, what they're saying over
the
there.
The UN has just published last night, Reuters published, no mainstream media, of course. Well, maybe by now, I don't know. It looks like the sarin gas attack was actually rebels. Which maybe I understand them being outgunned,
right.
You know, whatever, right? Well, actually, no. Sorry, I take that back. That's really
But that goes to the whole ambiguity. I mean, we sponsor certain ideologues out there. We don't know what we're doing, if they're going to turn, you know, against us or they're going to stay for us.
We know what we're doing. We want them. We want it. That's the horror of it. I shouldn't say it. I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, I feel it breaks my heart to say it, but we do. It's on purpose. We're not trying to stabilize, we're trying to destabilize. Because there's money in this war. There's money to be made.
Well, the ones that know are the ones on the top making the decisions. Those of us who drive that big cars every day to our jobs.
Or the kids that go die for him.
You know, exactly. It's just amazing because they keep it in a way, the media keep it in a way that it's completely isolated and it desensitizes everybody where you go like, well, okay, they must know what they're doing and we just let things happen.
But to reel back kind of to what Kodesh's like initial point, I mean, you see, it actually matters. At least I want to say that, you know, this is sometimes complicated and we're not entirely sure what needs to be done, but the choice of models in that textbook, you know, will end up killing people, you know? It matters. So, yeah.
I think it matters a lot in terms of not only what its consequences are, you know? I think it also matters into what can you really do about it and how do you start about doing that?
Not finding necessarily a counter. Right, I mean, because like we started, right, this not even hateful sometimes, but blaming and highly partisan discussion from both sides. In this case, if we're talking about kind of imperialistic wars and lame excuses for them, then you know the ball. We've spent 8 years blaming Republicans for it, and
right.
It's shocking to me that Democrats continue to blame Republicans for it. Excuse me, you know,
it's a lot of fun.
Well, sure, fine, they deserved it back then, no doubt, but it just drives me nuts, you know, with the Democrats forgetting that it's, in terms of escalating of imperial wars and bloodshed around the world, we've reached new heights
right,
in this current
right,
administration.
Right.
New heights. So, you know, so Jose is talking about how, about solutions, and I like that. So we don't want to just create the mirror image. Right. Oh, we've got a problem with Fox. Fox is a horrible propaganda nightmare. Yes, it is. So let's create one like just like it, but the one that gets Democrats all feeling fuzzy and warm. And we have MSNBC, and they're good people on MSNBC, and probably good people on Fox, though they probably got fired by now.
But actually, let me toss something out there.
Not a lot of good people.
The people at Fox just don't have a good sense of humor versus the ones at MSNBC seem to be better comedians. How's that?
But
what is funny is relative from my point of view.
I don't know, yeah. To me, it's not doesn't make not funny at all, frankly. I gotta
say. Do you get the joke or not? It's very relative.
Oh, of course, course. And I'm saying that as a negative towards them, because both of them, you know, pretty much lie to everybody, you know, just to meet their own agenda. As much as I do like MSNBC, some of those folks over there, I just have to say that between both right wing and, you know, extreme left, they're basically manipulating the media and
what
keeping
extreme
everybody
left, you know.
Well, I mean,
I try and publicize my favorite extreme left Americans, Black Agenda Report. They're just, you know, Glenn Ford every week.
But
puts
a
smile on my face.
That's just it. Nobody wants to come in the middle. Even CNN is just another tool of you know, confusion, really. I mean, it's just everything is a source of lies nowadays. And when everything is said and done, there's tons of people dead, and we're basically broke as a society. So it doesn't.
Ka-ching.
Yeah, it doesn't matter which side.
Yeah.
The people on the very top, the very select few, the industrial military complex, those are the ones, you know.
Though, you know, some of them, you know, you ask, it's got some access around here sometimes, you know, they don't do it cynically.
really. No, some do, surely.
Well, it's not personal,
but
it's business.
No, no, but most do not. Most are in, again, this kind of certainty combined with denial. So it's not that they're thinking there, I'm going to, got another opportunity, going to make money, people will die, I don't care. No, 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 they don't buy that. They persuade themselves that somehow they are making the world a better place. Now, sadly, people
but
around
the same
history
time,
did that
before. I think that, like, say, for example, Sander van der Linden just wrote in Salon and Scientific America, Why People Believe in Conspiracy Theories, an article on why people believe in conspiracy theories. And I think that a lot of it has to do with this self-affirmation and this trust of authority, you know, like, like not being able to listen to the good news about authority, right, makes you always see it as a bad thing, and consequently, you're gonna kind of feed the self-affirmation to the people that believe that authority is bad, for example. You know what I'm saying? And you can do exactly the opposite throughout propaganda, you know? But I think that that this self-affirmation process and the this conspiracy theory that's going on behind a lot of the way we treat, like, really irrelevant issues today in society is kind of very important to deal with. You know what I'm saying? And doing that in a way that you can still respect individuality and freedom of speech is quite a challenge to some extent.
Yeah, because it gets it co-opts a good healthy if you're talking about conspiracy theories are often they do smell a rat, and there is a rat where they're smelling it, but then I think, and maybe I'm all wrong, but I think often, more often than not, they go off in a bit of a tangent, and so they're not really hitting the real.
Perhaps they put the rat there. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I mean, you know, to say, you know, to look at things and say there's manipulation, we're not told the entire truth. Absolutely. I mean, history show tells us that again and again. After many years, we find out, yeah, there are a lot of things we weren't told, and you can see why. But then it often goes to. You know, nowadays it's really, I don't know, I'll admit to you, I think I've admitted it on the air, I find myself going there many times into the conspiracy world in my head, and there's still the voice of sanity on my shoulders telling me, watch it, you know, don't let yourself fall down the rabbit hole. But there are so many lies and manipulations, it's true, you know, but it's not Area 51, I think, and aliens, I don't know, but frankly, it's not my prime concern right now. But are there lies and manipulations? Hell yeah. Look at Syria.
Having that angel on your shoulder, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you have to cultivate that angel.
Kind of like recalibrate yourself every now and then and what your inner dialogue tells you, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, because we all are suffering from a certain mental breakdown if we're paying attention, aren't we?
Yeah,
I mean, it's hard to. It's worse to be you know, to be trusting in a large sense. I should think. I found that I actually was pulling up that because I haven't looked at that, and I want to hear what Scientific American has to say. There we go. Found that article, Why People Believe in Conspiracies, and I will definitely also post it to the blog for people who want to check it out, and we'll read it later. That sounds quite.
I think there was another version of it in Salon, and I went to look for it, and I couldn't find it again. So.
But I said, it's Michael Shermer too. I know him. He's a big skeptic for many years. He's a pretty big secularist, etc. So I'm sure he's a good writer too. So I look forward to read the, if Scientific American's version, I assume is the original, right? I used to. Been a while. I'm not subscribed anymore. I probably should. So conspiracy. I want to say it's like, you know, when you study propaganda and marketing and things like that a little bit, you find one of the things that are very important is to realize that, I'm so smart, I teach propaganda, so obviously propaganda and conspiracies don't affect me. Yes, they do. Right? When you say, this doesn't affect me, then it's actually pretty much opening the door for it to be particularly effective against you. So conspiracies too, you know. Go, give them some respect, you know. Don't shout them down, because that's like the other side of what you're saying, isn't it? The kind of the shout down. No, I'm not listening because you mentioned that you have something that doesn't make sense to you about 9/11. Oh, I'm listening. I'm not a truther. I'm really not. But I don't think that they should be called names and shut up as they are.
Yeah,
By people who otherwise are big on understanding just how terrible a foreign policy is and how many manipulations are going on and how Libya was a sham and all, well, most wars are really for profit and for nothing less. And they're quite on top of that. Maybe call them lefties or anti-imperialist conservatives like, you know, libertarians often are, or some of them are. But so why are you shouting these people down? You know, they have some... Is dialogue a sense of solution? Be aware of this stuff? One, surely, like you were saying. So what is the solution before we run out of time?
I don't know if conflict is avoidable, honestly. I that's an answer I do not know what it is, the answer. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I'm just saying, I think that if you expect to see changes in many of the ways we're kind of solving these irrelevant problems, through institutions that are kind of stop working for us, and there is truly some sort of rent-seeking behavior or power capture of any sort from any particular small group, I think that a first place to start is recalibrating ourselves of what we believe in, you know, and be skeptics and curious about what everything is feeding us, you know. I think that's where you start, because that's where you start kind of actually looking for alternatives. And if there is some agency in what you watch or what you read or all this stuff, I think that that's probably a cheap way of affecting the problem, you know. I think that I know you like Huxley, Brave New World, and George Orwell, right?
Mm, yeah, well. Who doesn't?
I think that I heard Huxley said, "Hey, Orwell had it completely wrong, because it's cheaper to convince people to reificate themselves using media than through oppression, right?"
Oh yeah.
So if you want to change institutions and stuff like that, I think that a good place to start is look at, hey, how can I recalibrate what I believe about institutions today? You know, in order to figure out solutions for them. I think that young people need to be doing this a lot.
So yeah, resist, whatever your perspective is, absolutely important. And of course, the education system doesn't really encourage that. I know how hard it is for me to persuade students that I will never hold their ideological position against them, just when they don't do the work. That's the only thing to lower your grade, period. You know, nothing else, ever. But, you know, it's, when you say that, I'm reminded of, because, you know, you're an alumni and stuff, so one of our professors, you know, feared by some, Charlie Rook, you know, once said to the, that he has this litmus test, right, that if you have a position, he asks you, well, can you think of some kind of argument or information or data I can provide to you that will change your mind? Right? Maybe it's not there, maybe because you're absolutely right, but can you even think of something that would change your mind? If you can't, then this is dogma. Then this is BS. You know,
this is not worth talking about.
Yeah, in fact, you are being a tool. You're being played.
Chris Rock made that argument at some point in stand-up comedy too. Ah. Like something like, if you already got your mind made up, when you're getting into an argument, why is the argument relevant anyways?
Yeah, you're being a puppet of other probably other groups, minorities probably, that are, and I mean it, of course, not racial minorities naturally, but economic minorities. Let's call them by their name. You know, the proverbial 1%, the banksters. So yeah, you're being played. It's one of the motives here too. I think you've really added a whole lot of stuff to think about on the mechanics of what we kind of try and talk about here, and I like how it's. Yeah, well, enlighten ourselves, you know, in a sense. Critical thinking, you know, there are no simple answers. Look for questions, complicated, or not better. Yeah. Better not to have answers than wrong answers and simplistic answers. Keep looking.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I think it could work out. It could work out. Just throwing it out there, see what people think, hopefully to read on the blog.
Yeah, and we'll continue this discussion. I believe we have to begin to start kind of wrapping up here and play our things. We will continue talking about this online, and etc. And have you on again now that I think we figured out. We'll have to figure out some kind of more economical better way of doing
absolutely.
This. And keep this this going. That's a brand new...
Economics might be useful in explaining a lot of these problems.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Because, yeah, you put some of the... You know, it's good to have somebody in you know, that has still time to think, you know, and not just a wage slave, right? And, you know, that's wonderful, yeah. Grad school, you know, and help us look under the hood a little bit and see what maybe some of the instincts we've had here, but how you need to look under the hood. Let's do the homework, as it were, you know? So,
cool. So anyway, thank you, Jose, for calling
in.
And,
discussing
some of those things with us. Again, Punkonomics, new time slot is from 4 o'clock every Monday here on WPRK, Winter Park, Florida. The best in basement radio, and of course, the voice of Rollins College. You can also catch Punkonomics for the next couple of weeks, also on Friday from 9 to 10 in the morning. What can I say? Until next time. Same place, same channel.
Bye.
Here on Punkonomics. And don't forget Secrets of the Fairies, which is on Wednesdays from 9 to 10. Take care, folks.
See you later.
Economically viable.
The preceding program did not reflect the views or opinions of the station, its management, or employees.
WPRK, Winter Park, Florida. I am John Lydon here of Public Image Limited. You may also know me as Rotten, and I may know you as WPRK.